Paid News Fellowship. Details at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 8 o'clock, and coming up next is on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. They point out that air traffic controllers demonstrate that workers still have power, and they take your calls.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Golden Years in the Red on Tuesday, January 29th at 5:30 p.m. at the Multnomah County Central Library in Portland. Golden Years in the Red with Student Debt will feature informational speakers and people who will share their stories about debt, including garnishment of Social Security checks for student debt when grandparents and parents co-sign student loans. Again, that's Golden Years in the Red on Tuesday, January 29th at 5:30 p.m. at the Central Library, 810 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor One Voice, an evening on Friday, February 1st at 7 p.m. at Unity Church in Portland. The One Voice event features a film screening of Unaccompanied, Alone in America, a documentary about immigrant children who have been separated from their parents while seeking refuge in the U.S., as well as performances by Jennifer Berezin and Chris Webster. This is a benefit for Immigration Counseling Service, Oregon's oldest nonprofit immigration law firm. Again, that's One Voice, Friday, February 1st at 7 p.m. at Unity Church, 4525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey.
Hey, solidarity forever.
Solidarity forever. There it is. Our work is done.
I are a union man.
You are a union man?
I was. Yep. I am. I headed the higher ed union for the state of for the community colleges and stuff for the state of Oregon.
Organization of professors?
Well, most of them were not professors.
Those meetings were exciting.
Oh, they were fun. They were really wild. Boy, those union people could play.
I was in a union one time in my life.
What one?
Early in my life, United Food and Commercial Workers.
Ah.
Yep.
You were a packer.
No, I was not. I worked in the grocery biz.
Oh.
But just for a little while.
I actually worked in Eastern Oregon, and I got to drive machines, large trucks and things. And at that point, the Teamsters dominated that world. And I said when I was told I had to go to their office to get hired. And I said to the guy, so what do I get for joining the union? And he said, you get to work.
That's, you know, I'm glad that was a good answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so this was a big week for labor.
It is.
That's why we're leading the way we are.
We're both celebrating and decrying.
Well, yeah, it was a big, both positive and negative for labor. First, the positive. The government shutdown is over. Why? Because a bunch of federal workers suddenly realized their power. It was a beautiful thing, really.
Yeah. Of course, the other factor in it is the idiot in charge.
Yeah, that is the other factor, indeed. If you weren't paying attention, last week the government shutdown came to an end when LaGuardia Airport shut down for a little while.
Right.
Because a bunch of air traffic controllers called in sick. They didn't even have to formally go on strike.
No.
Really, just the suggestion of a work stoppage was enough.
Well, I don't know. I don't fly that often. I used to for my work. But the thing is, man, there was these planes, and they go fast, and they're about 1,000 feet apart from each other, and they're going in different directions all at the same time, and it's hard to keep track, and I don't want that to go away.
Yeah, I think I feel pretty secure in saying we don't want planes to crash into each other.
No, nah, probably
bad
not.
When that happens. But all of that aside, it was a moment when American workers realized the power that they bring to the workplace.
Maybe.
I think that was...
Yeah,
that was made pretty clear if you're paying attention. The question remains, will the rest of America realize that? Will workers in different sectors realize that? Yes, air traffic controllers wield an exaggerated amount of power in a situation like this because you shut down a major airport in New York City, you cause a ripple effect that spreads across the continent and even beyond. And it's so disruptive to so much that obviously it's untenable.
Yeah,
and that's all it took. It was within hours of that that sick in that the government shutdown.
Pinning the failure of the Trump shutdown directly to the LaGuardia situation.
Yes, that doesn't solely explain the situation, but that was the proverbial straw.
I think so.
Yes.
No, I agree with you. I just.
Yep. So that was the good. That was the good part of labor's rocky week.
Okay.
The bad part was that here in Portland, the International Warehouse Workers, IWW, do I have that right? Industrial Workers
Industrial
of the World.
Industrial Workers of the World, please.
Sorry, excuse me.
That's okay.
Industrial Workers of the World, whose union hall is over on East Burnside Street, and which often serves as a host for various gatherings for various left-leaning organizations, including the Democratic Socialists of America. Who hold meetings there and workshops of various
kinds. Well, they've had successful union organizing locally.
They have had successful union organizing locally. The IWW union hall was vandalized.
Yeah.
Over the weekend. A window was broken. Graffiti appeared on the front of the house.
Says they're communists.
It says smash communism on one side and Antifa house on the other side.
Yeah. The latter being totally irrelevant and untrue.
The culprits were members of our old friends from Patriot Prayer, headquartered across the river in Vancouver, led by failed U.S. Senate candidate Joey Gibson, who came over apparently to disrupt the gathering of the Democratic Socialists.
Yes.
Yeah. There are, in fact, a couple of separate incidents over the weekend that culminated in the vandalism of the Union Hall.
Yeah, you know, I don't understand. Well, I do, but I can't fathom the degree to which the police seem to favor the fascists.
I'm sorry, it was not over the weekend. It was late last week.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
But you know, it's sort of weird. At the worst, I expect the police to be neutral. And I want to tell a story here really quickly, if you don't mind. When the police were trying to organize as a union in Portland, Oregon, they were blocked by the city over and over again.
Really?
Yeah, this is true. And what happened was the ILWU, the Longshoremen's Union, which has always been a strongly radical union ever since the 30s, told the police union that if the police put up informational pickets at the gates of the various shipping centers, if the police put up informational pickets saying there's a strike, the union contract would allow the longshoremen not to cross the line. And that meant that the Port of Portland would grind to a halt. And that happened. And that forced the city to the bargaining table. And that gave the police, ironically, their opportunity to organize and successfully be a labor union to bargain collectively. This is an important event, largely ignored in the history of labor in Portland.
Hmm. That's fascinating. I didn't know that.
You didn't know that. See, no. Most people don't know that because they don't like to talk about that.
Oh, no.
So
digging in a little more on this IWW hall business.
Yeah.
This was really the graffiti and the vandalism. This was the culmination of about a week's worth of focus on the IWW hall by fascists. Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys among them. They apparently showed up and tried unsuccessfully to disrupt a Democratic Socialists of America meeting on the 17th of January.
Uh-huh.
They tried to enter the building and disrupt it, but they were turned away at the door. one of these guys, a guy by the name of, apologies for pronunciation, Tusitala Tozi, Tiny is his nickname.
Described, I think he's a small guy.
Right. Described by Willamette Week as a right-wing brawler. He claimed on Facebook that he and another Proud Boy pulled a gun.
Really?
And, yes, and threatened DSA members by waving it around. But both the DSA and the police refute that claim. This is according to Willamette Week's reporting.
Yeah.
So this went on. A couple days later, Patriot Prayer supporters and the Proud Boys gathered outside the IWW house. They tried to mix it up with members of Antifa, who I guess had showed up due to the action on the 17th, but really nothing came of it. And finally, the vandalism in the wee hours of the 24th of January.
Right.
Yeah. So what we have here are fascists and unionists fighting each other. This is not a new thing in American history, is it?
No, indeed not.
Can you enlighten us a little bit about that?
Well, I don't want to spend a long time on a labor history.
Well, no, I think it's important here. It's important to understand this context.
Well, in this particular case, in the case of the West Coast, the ILWU was, that's the Longshoremen's Union, was the most progressive union under Harry Bridges. They fought and were shot at and killed and so on in San Francisco. I think it was 1934. It was a real struggle, which ended in a victory for the West Coast Union. The East Coast longshoremen, the ILA, were very corrupt and mafia dominated. So they dominated both the the Caribbean and the Atlantic coast. And the movie On the Waterfront took that as its subject matter. Now, of course, the movie On the Waterfront was the massive apology by Hollywood for having had a left history. And while it was a brilliant movie and made Marlon Brando even more of a star and so on, it was nevertheless essentially propaganda against organized labor, the way in which it was structured. Now, I mention that because this idea of corrupt unionism, not to mention the fact of corrupt unionism, has dominated the thinking of a lot of people. And the idea here is that somehow when you organize, when you put workers into a position of power, they will inevitably be retro and fascist. That is not true. It is not true historically. If we look at the rise of organized labor in America, it was a long struggle which really came to a head during the Great Depression of the 30s when the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, which is I should make this clear. There's two kinds of unions. There's trade unions, which are organized based on a trade, like steam fitters or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then there's industry organizing, where the whole industry, whatever your job, is in one union. And that's a stronger
like
position.
The food and commercial workers.
Yeah. Or the auto workers.
Right.
So when they began to do sit-ins, and stay in the plant, thus depriving the owners of the ability to smash them on the street, supported, I should say, by a large part of the old Roosevelt Democratic organizations, the organized labor became much more muscular, much more powerful, and much more ideological. And this is when we have the song Solidarity Forever. I wanted to start with that because that's a famous song, which was one of the songs sung by people to make them both braver and more bold in that struggle of the CIO. The CIO merged with the AFL about the same time that a decision had been made by the organized ruling class in America. I hate to use that kind of talk, but I don't know how else to put it.
Don't use it.
To smash.
It's apt.
To smash organized labor. And by branding the unions as commie, and by finding the more or less isolated members who were authentic leftists with a Soviet orientation, they were able to do that. And they did that in Hollywood, where the unions, in fact, were craft unions, and were very, you know, the idea that a script writer, a screenwriter, is somehow a laborer, which I believe is true, was not part of the American notion of organized labor. So there was this enormous kind of smearing of all of the left through its unions, which
kicked out a lot of great writers who ended up writing under pseudonyms and so on, made many people flee Hollywood, changed the nature of filmmaking. If you look at movies made during the era prior to the McCarthy period, you discover there's a lot of stuff that's good. There's Gentleman's Agreement, which deals with anti-Semitism. There's Home of the Brave, which deals with racism, black-white racism, and many other films with what used to be called message.
The Manchurian Candidate.
That's later. But as a result of that, we see a change in the way films were put out. We began to see an era of bland sitcom movies and musicals. Nothing wrong with either, but that was what there was. And if you had a real political orientation to your film, it didn't get made. And that went on for quite a long time until actually Kirk Douglas, of all people, decided to make Spartacus. Spartacus is a story of a slave revolt based on history of Rome. And he bought the book Spartacus, which had been written by Howard Fast, who was then labeled a communist. I mean, at that time, mm-hmm. labeled a communist. And then he turned to Dalton Trumbo, who was one of the biggest blacklisted writers in Hollywood. He's a genius writer, and he, in fact, had to publish and produce scripts under pseudonyms in order to work. In fact, he won 2 Academy Awards under names like Harold Smith and so on, because they didn't want to acknowledge him as who he was. Finally, because Kirk Douglas said, I'm not only going to buy this book and tell people, publicize that I'm buying this book by Howard Fast, the alleged leftist, I'm also going to hire Dalton Trumbo, the alleged communist, and give him screen credit for his script. And how, and because the fact that the guy who decided to do it was such an important figure in Hollywood, Kirk Douglas being a big moneymaker, mm-hmm. which is the measure of importance in Hollywood.
Right, in a lot of places.
It really broke the back of the blacklist. It broke the power of this development where anyone who wanted to work in the industry had to be vetted by right-wing sources. And it put an end to that. And thereafter, Hollywood was much more open and began to return to film that sometimes, not all films by any means, would have real content, real meaning, particularly real social meaning. So it's an important event. I didn't want to not mention it. Now we're in a situation where much of labor is moribund. We know that people's wages are stagnant, even as employment is high. We know that most places in most parts of the country do not have effective unionization. We also know, interestingly enough, that the IWW, which is the old traditional left-wing anarcho-syndicalist labor organization, that it has been successful in a number of actions, particularly in the case of one of the big burger outfits here in town.
Yep.
So they have some cred. And they are definitely ideologically to the left. So there's an interesting event going on. Meanwhile, and this is really creepy, as a result, I think, in large part of the enabling by Trump, who was not only a fascist, but was a big buddy of Roy Cohen, who was the guy. Am I going too much here, or can I keep...
A little bit, but it's interesting.
Well, Roy Cohen, who was a closeted gay person, mm-hmm. who... actually actively attacked the homosexual community and was a big buddy of the right wing, particularly of Joe McCarthy, who he worked for. Roy Cohen became a major figure in the movement to smash organized labor and to smash any kind of left-wing sentiment, and was part of the leadership that called the McCarthy period. In that period, Joe McCarthy became so egotistical and so arrogant and so alcoholic that he decided that among other things that he would attack would be the army for their communist influences, the U.S. Army, which is absurd. So they hired a very good New England lawyer, a guy named Walsh, who essentially watched as Joe McCarthy, under the guidance of Roy Cohen, attack one of the people in his law firm. And in the end, there was a great, the television was hungry for material in those days, so they ran those hearings during the day. They were well watched, and there was the sight of McCarthy being essentially put down by an outraged, very straight New England style lawyer. And that broke the back, because both McCarthy had overreached to attack the army as having communist influences, which is absurd. It broke the back of McCarthy. McCarthy ended up censured by the Senate, and being as how as he was an alcoholic to begin with, ended up essentially being, you know, just collapsing.
And Roy Cohn, of course, went on to be a father figure and mentor for a young New York businessman named Donald Trump.
Exactly. We have Trump saying in modern times, where's my Roy Cohn?
Yeah, exactly. I suppose we should probably tell people who we are and what the hell we're talking
about. Yeah, we didn't do it, did we?
No. this is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program on KBOO 90.7 FM, your community-supported radio station. My name is Abe Proctor.
I'm Joe Uris.
That verbose gentleman over there. It's Joe Uris. Joe, this is a time when I really appreciate the breadth and depth of your knowledge about this stuff.
Thank you.
That was cool. So we're talking about labor. It's ups and downs this past week. Most notably, the threatened work stoppage by air traffic controllers that brought the government shutdown to an end. And also the increasing level of confrontation between fascists and unionists here in Portland. Now, one contextual thing that I would like to point out here. Oh, and I should also mention 503-231-8187 is the number to call to take part in this conversation.
Call.
Also, you can reach us on Facebook at facebook.com/Abe and Joe. Also on the Twitter machine at HonestAbe72. All right. In the 1930s, as fascists came to power in Italy and in Germany and in Spain, a common feature of all of those movements was demonization of and violence against trade unionists.
And the left in general.
And the left in general, communists in particular. So this is not new under the sun, what we're seeing here. What I think makes this striking in the context of 21st century of America is that we haven't really seen this sort of thing in the United States for a long time, for decades. Open confrontations between fascists and trade union lefties, trade union affiliated people, on the streets of American cities. And it certainly appears that that is a growing trend, at least here in Portland.
Well, so it would seem, and from what I understand, now my politics are nonviolent. I don't like the idea of getting into a crowd, yelling, throwing stuff, and so on. I don't think it's a good strategy, and I don't think it's a moral activity. Nevertheless, I understand the impulses toward it, and I have noticed that the rise of a young anti-fascist movement here, who actually armor up like the Proud Boys and so on the right, is a thing, and it's happening, and it's real. And I also think that there's some evidence that the police seem to be biased against the left and for the right in the course of these struggles around City Hall and so on. I think it's important to understand that. We're not seeing some kind of neutrality here in law enforcement, even in this modern time. And it frightens me and it disturbs me, and I think it's something that needs to be understood and appreciated. The fact that some people from out of state cross the bridge and make trouble and are considered to be perfectly legitimate in their attacks, they're quite violent attacks, is disturbing to me.
Yeah. Listeners to this program will recall that back in August there was a big rally down on the waterfront by the Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer, and Antifa folks showed up in force to counter protest. I went down there and interviewed them. At least I tried to interview the Antifa side of the street, but they wouldn't talk to me. Not a one. Talked with some of the fascists on the river side of Front Avenue down there. But what you point out is absolutely true. In observing the police as they were deployed that day, their focus was overwhelmingly on the leftist side of the street. And I'm not using side of the street as a metaphor here. Literally, they were keeping the two groups separated on either side of NATO Parkway, down by the fountain. There,
which
on the
is
waterfront.
Not inappropriate in and of itself.
Not at all. In fact, tactically, if I wanted to keep those two groups separate, and clearly that was a good idea, you use a natural barrier like the street to do so. But in separating those two groups, you could see just by looking at the police where their attention was. There was a line of armored police in the middle of the street, all of them facing towards the Antifa folks with the fascists to their backs. And then later on, when a scuffle finally did break out between the two groups, the police employed force, and it was directed against the leftist counter-protesters rather than the white supremacists who were marching armed and armored on the streets of Portland.
Yeah.
That's a problem. I really would like to know how we're going to address that.
And I would like to know why it's happening this way and why the city government ignores the reality of it.
Indeed. Actually, I'm hoping that the people who were recently elected to the city council and the balance that has shifted there since the election, I'm hoping we're going to see some forward motion on these issues.
Well, I'm hoping that would be true, too. I have to say that I had, when our new police chief was appointed, our people, our station, and I reached out repeatedly to the new chief, inviting them on the air here. Mm-hmm. The only radio time that I know that the new chief did, now I was, you know, and this is my stereotypes, my prejudices, I'm thinking African-American woman, perhaps more liberal or different in her perspective, at least different than the usual appointees for chief of police in Portland. I was ignoring the fact she came from Oakland. Oakland, as you know, was the place that gave birth to the Black Panthers because of the violence, mm-hmm. the repeated violence of the police in Oakland.
Also a rich history of organized labor in Oakland.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I was hoping to get a chance to give the woman a chance to talk about what she wanted to see happen with the police and how she saw policing. We never got a response. On the other hand, within a very short time, she was on the Lars Larson show. Now, I've known Lars for years, and he's the kind of guy who carries a concealed weapon.
That's right. You guys play golf together, right?
Well, we got to argue. I never get to play golf because I'm really bad, and I'm poor. Anyway, so Lars got the interview. I didn't really care that we didn't, but I felt a little hurt that there was no response by the police department. Now, it's possible that somehow communication fell apart, but it was repeated communication, and it was clear that nothing was going to happen there. I still want to extend the invitation. I would welcome, either on in our station or at a mutually neutral spot, an interview with the chief of police, and I would respect her, and I would want to have her opinions. I might add that the problem with her coming here is that we have a rule against guns. And I can't imagine a police chief going unarmed anywhere. Now, not necessarily she herself, but somebody, her bodyguard or whatever.
Right, right. I would listen to that interview.
Yeah, it would be a good interview.
Yeah,
be hot,
I totally,
hot,
totally
hot.
Agree.
And I want to be clear here. I have a large respect. When Rosie Sizer was the police chief, she and I actually would have serious conversations. Now, she was married to the then head of the sheriff's department. No question about her politics or her orientation, but she was a very civil and reasonable person who could carry on a reasonable discourse while disagreeing.
Hmm. That's becoming more and more rare these days.
I think, I'm afraid so.
You and I, for example, are pretty far from reasonable, I would say.
Yeah.
All right. This is KBOO 90.7 FM on your radio dial. I'm Abe. That's Joe. By the transitive power of talk show naming, this is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show.
Oh, wait, is that our name?
The Transitive Property, yes.
Transitive Property, wow, yeah. That's intellectual.
Coming up this morning at 9, an alternative radio journalist and professor Nathan Schneider discusses the long history of cooperatives in the United States. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Stage and Studio, D-May discusses the play Hazardous Beauty with playwright Bonnie Ratner and director Josie Side. At 11:30 Art Focus, Amanda Clem interviews artist Manu Torres about his floral still lifes at Russo Lee Gallery. All of this and more coming up this morning on KBOO.
You know, people are starting to call us, and I think we should give them an opportunity. 231-8187. Jeremy, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I, unless I misheard you, I think you said something. Perhaps you misspoke.
I often misspeak.
Yeah, as we both know.
Jeremy. Okay, go ahead.
You said something to the effect of, when you were talking about how the cops have, you know, clearly favored the evil ones in the various confrontations that they've mostly started. And you said you expected police to be at worst neutral. Well, I think that's actually backwards. I expect the police to take the side of, you know, property and
well, generally they do. You're right.
And so when they I it's very rare that they're anywhere near as good as liberal. I'm sorry, as good as neutral. So it's you know, it's like walking into McDonald's and wondering why they don't have a prize winning veggie burger. You know, you don't go to the police and expect, you know, neutrality or God forbid,
Jeremy, I just don't quite understand your argument. Are you saying that the police are essentially the instrument of the ruling class? Is that it?
Yes, I would say that.
Okay.
And one of the few nuggets that I retained from my short, sad period as a Trotskyist in my 20s is police out of unions was one of their slogans. And I think they're right about that. That this is, you know, these are not workers. I realize they have families and they need wages and have to pay their mortgages. But unions are a place for something other than the behavior of the sort of normal job description of a cop. And I think as long as, you know, and when I was a sanitation worker in New Orleans, I supported the police wildcat, but they certainly did not support ours. In fact, they broke it. So I really don't see a whole lot of solidarity that's going to obtain there. You know, they have to cross sides, and I don't think the union's going to help them do that. Especially the police union in Portland is particularly grotesque.
Well, I was reciting some history that's important that most people
don't
know.
And it was a good anecdote, and I wasn't suggesting that you think that police unions are necessarily a good thing. In fact, I wonder what your opinion is.
Well, look, I think that any group of workers, whatever their work, have the right to, should, and really do have the right to organize and have the right to represent themselves to the management. And I think that the police union, I find kind of disgusting in many ways, it was right for them to join with the ILWU, which is a pretty much of a one of the few sort of left-wing unions left in America. It was right to have them support them, to have them have an organization. Now, as to the politics of it, well, you cannot expect the police, who are inherently the representatives of the ruling class in the way police work in this country or elsewhere, anywhere, including Russia or Italy or anywhere, you cannot expect the police to be liberal or left. But you can expect them particularly in our society, to allow freedom of speech, which is something that I feel like they're not adequately doing at this time. Anyway, I want to go on because we have a lot of people calling.
One more note on this before we move on.
Sure.
I agree with everything you said about working people in various industries banding together for their own self-interest. That's really the only power that workers can exert in the marketplace. It becomes problematic with law enforcement officers, however, because they are carrying out, they're really not just turning out for a shift of work. They're carrying out a very explicit function of the state. And so this leads to, as you mentioned, a closing of ranks when there's misconduct on the behalf of one or more officers. The presence of police unions is one of the biggest reasons that so many officers who use lethal force don't face any consequences, not just here in Portland, but all over the country.
That's true. That's true.
And that's a big problem. And that's really the confluence of two opposing tensions, right? The understandable desire of a union to protect their own, and the people's demand that justice be done when force is applied unreasonably and often in a bigoted way.
No, I think you're right. I think we should take some more calls because we're getting a lot of calls.
Yeah, I think we should.
231-8187. Angela, you're next.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. I'm a really bad public speaker, but I really felt it was important to call about this because I have a little bit of knowledge about it. I observed some of the terrorizing of the Patriot Prayer and Proud Boys. My office is on the same block as the building that houses the IWW and some Democratic Socialist meetings. Mm. And they have, their display was completely, you know, completely left to boil over as long as they wanted to by the Portland police on January 19th. Saturday afternoon, lots of pedestrians out on the street. There was no one fighting against them. There was no alleged Antifa there, you know, to be violent with or anything else. The police had originally showed up and they didn't interact with them, didn't ask them to stop harassing people. They harassed my clients. They tried to intimidate me just because I asked them to leave, because they were creating quite a public disturbance for about an hour. And then they created a mob assault where they assaulted someone. And a shop owner had to pull this person in to safety and lock the door.
Oh, really?
Yes, yes. I observed the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I placed a 911 call, which was a very strange response on the other end. And the shop owner who pulled the victim in did as well. But I just really want people to know that they are, have become, you know, I'm not some, you know, mask wearing, obvious looking Antifa, you know, supporter and I'm a business owner, right? They didn't care who was on that block. And it was just them being allowed to vent and be violent by the Portland public, Portland police. But the other thing I really wanted to say, I think I had come down to speak to you directly after your show, after the August 4th rally. I really take issue with you guys calling people on the left Antifa. That rally on August 4th was full of everyday people like myself.
Oh, there were. Absolutely, there were.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry, yes, if we left you that impression. I did not think it was only Antifa.
Yes, because there were many, and I think there's some retaliation going on here, as well as trying to sway the public opinion about socialism. The Democratic Socialists, as well as union groups, had a really strong, unified representation down at that rally, and they're taking, you know, the initiative to stand up against the fascism and the violence, and I think it's really brave. And I tried to explain to the Patriot Prayer people that, and they identify themselves to me as the Proud Boys in Patriot Prayer. I tried to explain to them that I consider myself anti-fascist, although I'm not a member of Antifa in their traditional sense of the word.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think any decent person should be. My husband is Jewish. My son goes to a school with 70% kids of color. You know, I don't know why the police aren't protecting us in this. It's really disturbing to me. And that's exactly what I really learned for myself that day, is the police had no intention. In fact, they said they couldn't send a response unless people were willing to speak to police. And I had to then say, oh, well, what if someone gets really seriously hurt? They're saying I can't call 911? And it's a very strange call. And I really urge everyone, everyday citizens that maybe feel safer speaking out about it, to document the things that they see, document the harassment. You know, it's important to know that it's not just some political ideological fight. It's people that are armed and dangerous, you know,
yep,
using free speech as this guise to really just terrorize people. And I really don't like speaking on the air. So,
well, you've done quite well for yourself.
So I'll just let someone else go. Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much for the call. Yeah, she's right. We need to be careful about painting with too broad of a brush here about the folks who turned out in opposition to the fascist groups walking on the streets.
Well,
of Portland.
That's really true.
Yeah. What I have a problem with, and this is speaking just for me, I don't know how you feel about this, Joe, and I don't know how you, the listeners, feel about this, is that when I went to that gathering, you know, I saw the people on the left side of the street, so to speak, and among them was a group of Antifa. You could not miss them. They were clad in black. They were all gathered together in a tight formation, and they were armored. They were carrying body shields. They were wearing helmets with masks. I saw some batons. They showed up ready to fight. That's what I have a problem with.
This is an interesting. This is an interesting issue. I hadn't really planned on our talking about this so much today, but it is very important. My training, my orientation, as I think I've said several mm-hmm. times, is toward nonviolence. I think it's not only moral, but I think it's a good tactic. I think it's particularly truly a good tactic when you have a huge amount of support for right-wing violence, which we're beginning to see more and more on the streets.
Indeed.
Of Portland.
And we're seeing that support from the very top. The very top.
Yeah, and I think that's very important to know. So,
wait,
go ahead.
I'm not quite done with this one yet.
Oh, sorry.
All right. Now, that said, my problem with the Antifa forces who came up, you know, girded for battle, that's what I have a problem with, the use of violence as a political tactic, as you just said. However, it's not difficult for me to see how they got to that place, especially when you consider how things were arrayed on that day. You had fascists marching in the light of day in our city, carrying shields and weapons of their own, ready, showing up in many cases. And I had people explicitly tell me this, that they showed up to fight with Antifa. And then you're on the other side of the street and you're a leftist and you're looking at this and you're seeing the Portland police out there protecting fascists. I could see how you'd get to a place where you go, well, if the state is not going to deal with white supremacists threatening violence on the streets, then it falls to us, the citizens, to do so. I see how they get there. I don't necessarily agree with that tactic or that position, but I see how they get there.
No, I definitely think it's a tactical question rather than a moral question in this particular instance. But I think we should go more to our callers and give them more chance.
Sure.
Let's go to 2318187. Let's go to Barth. You're next.
Good morning. your previous caller, the woman who said she can't talk on the air, you did really well, and thank you for doing
it. Yeah, absolutely.
Your comments should be funneled to some place where they can do more explicit good, although mm-hmm. broadcasting them on the air is good, but get in touch with Cop Watch. Go to the
That's a very good suggestion.
You know, there are mechanisms to help people gain power or to at least exert some power. About the Antifa members showing up ready to fight. I'm of mixed feelings about this, and they apparently restrained themselves. But the other part of this coin on lots of labor history will show you that if you don't come up with some big guys to, you know, walk your front line, then the other side can wade in with some impunity and cause damage someplace, sometimes life damage to some of their victims.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thought. Solidarity Forever is on the tune of Glory, Glory, Hallelujah, which most people will recognize, but a lot of those early Union songs were based on traditional music so that everybody could go with the tune.
Right.
The air traffic controllers, people are, you know, there's been some comment about, well, why didn't they just go out and shut down the airports, you know, and do that sooner and do that nationwide and exert their influence. But we got to remember that in August of 81, PATCO, the union they had, went out on strike for higher wages and better working conditions and a lot of things that were useful. But Reagan said this is an illegal strike because they are prohibited by contract and by law from striking. And he fired 11,000 plus air traffic controllers.
Mm-hmm.
And besides firing them, he made a lifetime ban on their rehire. And Rudy Giuliani was his front man for that.
Mm-hmm.
Just to remind people that, you know, some of his history. But that strike made replacing striking workers acceptable. It made that a new standard, because in the older previous to that, you know, it was pretty difficult socially to hire and keep scabs on after the strike was over, but now not so much. Bill Clinton actually lifted that ban, and about 850 were rehired after 1993, which is a long time to wait to get your job back. The no-strike ban bars workers from future federal government job employment if, quote, he or she participates in a strike or asserts the right to strike against the government of the United States. That's the text of the law. The people who are calling in sick, you know, God bless them, life is tough, and a lot of them used the excuse that they could not afford to go to work, that they had to do other things in order for them to float their life and their family.
Yeah, no, that's true.
So, you know, it's a big deal that they did put the pressure on the government, put the pressure on the air system, put the pressure on the public, and a lot of the people in the country were behind them, despite what blathering comes out of the White House saying, oh, everybody's on our side. Not true.
Okay.
Those are my big points. I'm going to let you go. Thanks
great.
For your help.
Thanks for your I'm going to let you go, bye. Too. Thank you very much for the call, man.
All right, let's go to Ross. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, my friends. I have a couple of points I want to make, but one is addressing the business of Antifa and nonviolent civil disobedience. The organization of a demonstration under principles of nonviolent civil disobedience doesn't have any place for Antifa. Now, if people want to organize in a different way, and you know, we could make deals with the mafia, bring in some goons and protect our demonstrators, and we'd call them our protectors, but that's not nonviolent civil disobedience. We just celebrated King's birthday, so let's not lose sight. The great power of nonviolent civil disobedience is in the incredibly energy and discipline of going forward in the face of being expectation that you might be beaten or something by onlookers, or you might be beaten by the police. Okay, that's the first point. Number two, the police. I'm almost, if I listen to P.K.B. Moore, I'm going to organize an organization which will be to defend the integrity of the police. I'm almost thinking they're going to have to be a protected class. It is not right to demonize a class of people. I don't care if they're steam workers, if they're unionists, if they're what, communists or Jews or black. We do not demonize a category of people, and KABU and you folks are just demonizing
the police. I disagree. What we did earlier, let me take the description of the August waterfront rally as an example. We criticized tactics, police tactics. We didn't issue a blanket condemnation of police.
Okay, well, just keep that slippery slope in order, because demonizing is not cool.
It's a fine point, but it's
We want to call the police, and when they don't come and they don't behave properly, we criticize them because we keep an eye on the prize, and that is, I want the police to be my servants, my protectors, and I want my sons, my cousins, and friends to sign up and want to become police when they grow up, and I want my friends who are police to be treated with respect, and I also want us to appreciate wonderful, good police behavior that we have. And I challenge you, someday devote a program, ask people to come in to call and share all the good police services they have, and they want to respect. Okay, that's mean. The other thing is, for goodness sakes, cut the new police chief a little slack, okay? And don't demonize her because she's a policeman. And I think it's very petty to complain that she hasn't talked on your show. Give her some time, okay? Anyway, that's what I wanted to share.
All right, hey, thank you for the call. Let's go to Nick.
Hello, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
So I just heard the tail end of that last caller. I could respond to that, but I actually wanted to talk about police as far as both Antifa and protest culture and social services in this town. I'm a Portland native. I was at the June 30th rally downtown as well, the now infamous riot. And I've also, so as far as police towards Antifa, I was volunteering as a medic during the June 30th rally, and there was kind of, I hesitate to call it friendly fire, but there was, I remember treating a woman who had been hit in the head with tear gas, with a tear gas canister, and cut a giant laceration in her head. And, you know, when you were talking earlier about you know, police guarding Patriot Prayer, that behavior was also on display there as well on the June 30th protest. They were blatantly kettling or attempting to kettle and or enclose left-wing activists and formed a protective cordon around Patriot Prayer. I also, it's just as far as policing in general in this town, I work in social services. I've worked in a homeless shelter, and I've personally seen police officers blatantly assaulting homeless individuals in this town as well. So I that's basically what I wanted to say, is that the police culture in Portland, I respect that there are certain maybe individual officers that are doing the best that they can, but police culture in Portland is on the whole, I would say, rather negative, and we need to take a really strong look at police culture in this town as far as it goes to leftists and marginalized communities.
Well,
that's all I have to say.
No, I appreciate the comment. I think there's something that needs to be understood historically. The police in any city, anywhere in the world, are the representation of the ruling class. This has always been true, whether they were Cossacks in Russia or the secret police in China or whatever. Police represent the ruling class, and that's almost always the case, and it's inevitable. And that is just a fact of the struggle of working people in the world. But that is not to demonize per se each individual officer. I actually developed several working relationships with and even friendships with individual officers in Portland. That doesn't mean that I don't have a real perspective on what the police are and what they do and who they're working for. It ain't me. But I want to thank you for the call, and I really think it's very important that we understand the difference between interactions amongst individuals and an organization which serves inevitably the ruling class.
All right, let's go to Joe. Joe, good morning.
Thanks for taking my call and for sure. This topic this morning. I just wanted to make a couple points. One of them had to do with letting listeners and you know about a labor struggle you may not know is currently unfolding. The county of Multnomah County employs regular workers, and they also employ temporary workers and workers who work on an on-call basis. And those temp and on-call workers have not been allowed to be in the union for a long time. And a couple years ago, a majority of workers signed cards to join AFSCME Local 88. I went out and helped sign some of them up. And the county has been resisting that, has been denying to recognize them and allow them to be a part of our bargaining unit. And I think that's something people should kind of recognize is happening in our own town. That, you know,
no, that's good information.
Where we think progressive like labor relations exists, that's going on. So if you have any like contact with Multnomah County or connections, like put pressure on them or support your on-call worker if you have one in your life and let them know that you support them joining the union.
No, I think that's a good idea. I want to be clear on this. I grew up in a union family. I've been active in union work, but middle class for the most part. And I have seen in my brief history in Portland, beginning back in 1958, then going into 1959, 60, the busting of the unions in the newspapers here in town. I watched how the Oregonian made secret deals with the Oregon Journal, the then evening newspaper, to buy it at a certain point and then close it at a certain point thereafter. I also saw how they shut out the workers deliberately. And in that lockout, all the workers in the newspaper, the writers, the various laborers and guilds and the skilled people, the printers and so on, were shut out. That strike went on for a long, long time, and eventually it was lost. It was lost in part because I think there was another kind of deal going down within labor here in town. And I don't want to spend time on this, but I can discuss that with people. Also, there was a stupid effort by a number of angry unionized workers or members of unions who actually blew up trucks, which persuaded the public to not be supportive of the unions at all. That's something people I don't think even remember.
Yeah. Yeah, see, using violence tends to not win you supporters.
Well, no, and I think it's a stupid tactic. And I think it's particularly not only stupid, but immoral. It's not necessary in most situations. And I really think it's inevitably going to lead to bad outcomes. Anyway, that's me. Right. Let's go to...
One more point on this. So if we're looking towards the impetus for this... This resurgence of political violence on the streets of the United States, look no further than the movement that really came to light after the election of Barack Obama. They called themselves the Tea Party at that point. Tea Party is still around. But we didn't have fascists marching openly before Obama. And we did, certainly since the election of Donald Trump, they feel like they've got carte blanche to disrupt meetings of the Democratic Socialists. Listen, I've talked with the Democratic Socialists here in Portland, and they are about the least threatening, least harmful group of people you could possibly imagine. And now they are facing the prospect of having their peaceful meetings disrupted by armed fascists. That is where we are right now in the United States of America.
And I want to say something on my own part. I've been thinking about this a long time, and it's probably not a very important thing to say, but I'm going to be looking to join the DSA.
Huh.
I have old time, good old friends who are founders of that, and hey, it's about time I showed up. So I'm going to do that if I can get a hold of them.
Okay.
Yeah, let's go to Mike.
Let's go to Mike. Good morning.
Morning, KBOO.
Yeah.
If people in any way have any doubt of the power of unionizing, federating, associating, just look to the powers that be and how many thousands of federations and associations they have and their union organizations. It's, you know, the reason they fight people's ability to unionize and associate is because they know how powerful it is. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Well, I think this is this whole question of these number of questions, unionization, the struggle of the working people, the history of these things, all of it needs to be covered more here at KBOO. Yeah, and I think you and I can do that to some degree.
Yeah. It's disturbing to see a resurgence in the historic confrontations between unionists and fascists.
Right.
It's not an indicator of a healthy political discourse. Right. Let me put it that way.
Right. And where my disagreements are have more to do with tactics and morality than the necessity of opposing fascism. I believe that's an absolute necessity.
Yes. We should all be anti-fascist, should we not?
I think so.
Yes. But we should not dress up in body armor and go out and fight the fascists.
Well, that's not my style. Let's just say that.
Yeah, so this has been a really interesting conversation.
Yeah, I think it was very useful. And there's a lot of history to be talked about and a lot of it deliberately forgotten. I really believe that the way we teach American history in our schools glorifies leaders and denies realities and makes the country's history virtuous by its very nature rather than being critical and examining the power structures and struggles that formed the nation.
And I think I can say this unambiguously. The path to a once again prosperous working class lies through unions and organizations and through a Green New Deal.
I agree.
Yeah.
I think we are of one mind on this.
I think we are. And I think we're going to talk more about labor, I think, on this program going forward. And in closing, I would just like to say one thing completely off topic, if I might. And that is immunize your kids, people.
Yeah.
Immunize your kids.
Don't swallow this weird nonsense about immunization being some kind of deadly thing.
Vaccines are good for public health. Immunize your kids. Vaccinate your kids.
Right.
That is all.
All right. That's it for us for today. I want to urge you to stay tuned to KBOO. Remember, it's the best in public affairs broadcasting and the best in music.
Forever, for the union makes us strong.
It is we who plowed the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. Now we stand outcast and starving mid the wonders we have made.
The time now is 9 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next on Alternative Radio, journalist and professor Nathan Schneider discusses the long history of cooperatives. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and 11, On Stage and Studio, DMA discusses the play Hazardous Beauty with playwright Bonnie Ratner and director Josie Seed. At 11:30 on Art Focus, Amanda Clem interviews artist Manu Torres about his floral still lifes at the Russo Lee Gallery. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by member support. If you're not a member and you'd like to become one, please go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Real Music Film Festival through February 16th at the Whitfield Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. On Thursday, January 31st, the Real Music Festival will screen the documentary Solo, The Evolution of the One-Man Band. This film investigates the history and present-day atmosphere of this special art form. Again, that's the Real Music Film Festival showing Solo, The Evolution of the One-Man Band on Thursday, January 31st at 7 p.m. at the Whitsell Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the screening of the documentary film Big Money Agenda on Sunday, February 10th at 6:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Big Money Agenda explores the effects of money in politics, Citizens United, as well as solutions to the issues of money in politics that's preventing real change. There will also be a discussion after the film.